I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times.
There's a program called The Shine that's in Pennsylvania, rural counties of Pennsylvania, that provides after-school educational programs for individuals in those areas, which just so happens to be the state that helped propel President Trump to the White House. I'm curious what you say to those Americans in a community where they tell me today that 800 individuals will no longer, children who need it most, will no longer be provided in those most needy of communities the educational care they need.
I'm not familiar. Y'all are an advantage over me because I have to memorize all 4,000 line items. But so let's talk about after-school programs generally. They're supposed to be educational programs, right? I mean, that's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to help kids who don't get fed at home get fed so they do better in school. Guess what? There's no demonstrable evidence they're actually doing that. There's no demonstrable evidence they're actually helping results, helping kids do better in school, which is what, when we took your money from you to say, look, we're going to go spend it on an after-school program, the way we justified it was, these programs are going to help these kids do better in school and get better jobs.
That was White House Budget Director Mick Mulvaney at a press conference yesterday describing one of the many programs on the chopping block in President Trump's budget blueprint. In fact, domestic programs and services for low-income Americans appear to be the biggest losers if this budget were passed, along with the State Department, the EPA, the National Endowment for the Arts, among others. The Defense Department, Veterans Affairs, and Border Security would see an increase in their budgets. We asked Gregory Cordy to join us. He's been writing about the budget proposal for USA Today, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Presidents don't write budgets. Congress does. What has been the response from Congress so far, from the Republicans and the Democrats?
Well, presidents do write budgets under the Budget Act of 1974, I think it is. The president's supposed to submit a budget to Congress. But you're right, Congress does put this all together, and then the budget is the first part of the process, and then they appropriate the money. The reaction has been mixed, obviously. Even within Republican caucus, there's some opposition to some of these cuts. Some of these programs have survived for decades as popular programs that support state and local government initiatives.
Right. From what Mulvaney said yesterday, and even looking at this budget proposal, this blueprint, what is the criteria? And what we heard from Mulvaney describing this after-school program, a school that provides food, I should say, for children, what is not working about that, considering that children need to be fed?
Well, this has been a longstanding problem for the federal government. There is a law called the GPRA Modernization Act, and I can't even remember what GPRA stands for, but the idea is to try to put some performance measures behind federal programs. And it's very difficult to gauge the success of a program like this 21st Century School Learning Initiative. Is the object to get kids to learn better, or is it to keep them out of trouble after school, or to provide social services? And those are the kinds of things that I think the OMB director is referring to when he says it's really kind of hard to measure the success of some of these programs.
I don't have it all at my fingertips, but I know a number of people have looked at some of these programs saying, yes, indeed they do. And I guess this will be some of the pushback coming from this budget blueprint, talking about the fact that when you invest in children early on and they have a meal before they start their classes, chances are they're going to be able to pay better attention. I don't need to argue this with you. Also, Meals on Wheels is another one that could lose some money. Again, this is really basic stuff for low-income people.
Yeah, Meals on Wheels gets funded really by state and local governments. It's not technically a federal program. But the Community Development Block Grant Program, which is a 40-year-old method for the federal government to disperse community development money to counties and cities as an anti-poverty program, that does fund Meals on Wheels in many cities.
One of the reactions to this budget proposal, and I'd be curious of what you think, Gregory, is that when you look at least the programs that could either be eliminated or their funding reduced, that it does affect proportionately low-income Americans and perhaps a large segment of the population that voted for Trump. These are people living in rural areas who are struggling with their job losses and with their various social needs. Do you think they will pay some of the brunt? I realize this is a work in progress, but do you think they are particularly targeted?
Look, I mean, look at the Appalachian Regional Commission, which serves, I think, 420 counties in places like West Virginia, Ohio, Western Pennsylvania, all the way down into Northern Georgia, I think. That is Forgotten America. Remember?
Mm-hmm. I do.
Trump,
I remember Forgotten America. Yes.
People. Yeah. Coal miners. We hear about coal miners all the day from this White House. And the Appalachian Regional Commission is the kind of federal program that tries to do community development in some of these old coal mining towns that have suffered from our transition to other forms of energy.
Now, this blueprint is 55 pages, and I don't know in Washington, is that a lot of pages? Is it a little amount of pages? I'm curious about whether it provides a kind of typical details you might get from a White House.
This is what's called a skinny budget, and that's because this is President Trump's first year in office, so he hasn't really had the chance to fully develop a budget proposal. That will come in late April, maybe May, and that will have a more fleshed out series of tax cuts and line items in it. This, even for a skinny budget, is pretty skinny. Mm. President Obama and President Bush, in their first budgets, their skinny budgets were in the hundreds of pages.
Now, this is about discretionary spending. It's getting us a bit in the weeds, but this is an important distinction when it comes to the federal budget. What does that mean?
Well, most of the spending in the long term, the things that are driving the deficit and the debt, are entitlement programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. This is the spending that Congress controls from year to year through the appropriations process. It's the spending that Congress has the most control over, this budget does absolutely nothing to reduce the deficit or the debt.
Mulvaney said you can't drain the swamp and leave people in it. The idea that if you're going to cut money for EPA or the State Department or the National Endowment for the Arts or the other programs, people are going to get laid off. Do we know is that figured into this budget, how big a layoff we might anticipate?
What Director Mulvaney says is that those layoffs are largely up to the agency directors and cabinet secretaries that from the departments that can take the cuts. We know maybe 3,500 at the EPA. Other departments, it's tough to tell at this point, but this is actually a big issue in the Washington metropolitan area, as you can imagine, because we have a lot of federal employees, and we're going to see a decrease in federal employment if this budget gets adopted.
Who at least on paper, has the biggest hit?
You look at foreign aid is one category. So the State Department on paper takes a big hit, but what the White House is saying is that doesn't go to sort of core diplomatic efforts, but foreign aid is obviously a very important diplomatic tool that we have in many parts of the world to be able to encourage the kind of development that we want and kind of security that we want. And the argument is that it's a lot cheaper than sending in troops. The EPA takes a big hit. The Department of Education takes a big hit. The Department of Housing and Urban Development takes a bit. A lot of domestic programs, with the exception of the VA.
Right.
And NASA takes a very small hit, but most domestic programs are going to get cut.
Can we say the Defense Department is the big, quote-unquote, winner, at least in this proposal?
Oh, absolutely.
We're talking, what, $54 billion?
$54 billion offset by $54 billion in domestic spending cuts. So a lot of Apache helicopters and troops and training and equipment, facilities, bases, ships, a lot of munitions, a lot of things on the defense side. And then the other thing that also benefits is the Department of Homeland Security, the border wall, Customs and Border Protection, immigration enforcement officers, those will get beefed up.
And is the funding for the wall, or at least partially for the wall, is that in this budget proposal?
There's a down payment for the wall. Now, we still don't know how much the wall is going to cost. The estimates are all over the map. But this would pay for no more than 10%, even under the most optimistic estimates of how much it's going to cost.
Now, the president has talked about, and he did this certainly on the campaign trail, and I believe as president, that he wants to spend something like a trillion dollars to rebuild or build our infrastructure. Is there anything in this budget proposal that would address that?
No, and as a matter of fact, it cuts infrastructure. Now, what they're saying is that they're cutting these old, inefficient infrastructure programs in favor of this package that they're going to put forward later this year. What they're putting forward is a public-private financing option. We expect a lot more toll roads, I would expect.
Mm-hmm.
But the sort of basic way that a lot of highways and airports and ports and harbors have been paid for over the year, they're going to get cut, at least in the short term, in this budget.
So what happens next? So here's the budget blueprint. People are reacting to it. What's the next move, either from Congress or the White House?
Well, the president proposes and Congress disposes. That's the old
is that how it works?
On Capitol Hill. Yeah, so even status quo budgets are often dead on arrival. You have to remember that Congress, for the past decade or so, really hasn't done a whole lot of appropriating. We go from temporary spending bill to temporary spender bill. We call them a continuing resolution, or CR.
Mm-hmm.
We're on a CR right now. And Congress punts the big decisions until the next budget. And so you don't see Congress really rolling up their sleeves and decide, well, we're going to want to give this agency a little bit more, this agency a little bit less. A lot of the budgeting they've been doing has been across-the-board increases or across-the-board cutting.
This has to be offset. We're almost out of time here, but if they're looking to spend, let's say, $54 billion for defense, they have to find $54 billion to offset that?
Yes, that's the way it works. They say it balances, at least on paper, in the fiscal year 2018 with $54 billion increase to defense and $54 billion cut from domestic programs. But again, we do not yet know what he's going to propose in terms of tax cuts. So it's tough to know what the long-term impact this is going to have on the national debt.
Do you anticipate a government shutdown?
I would not think so. Remember, we have Congress and the White House controlled both by Republicans. So usually a shutdown is this game of chicken about who's going to get blamed. If the government shuts down, here it's very clear that if the government shuts down, it's going to be the Republicans.
Well, Gregory Cordy, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Absolutely.
And he's been writing about the budget proposal for USA Today. After this very short break, I'll be talking with Bill Hayes, and we'll be talking about Oliver Sacks. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I had the privilege of interviewing neurologist Oliver Sacks on many of his books and always look forward to our conversations. He was one of my favorite guests. Brilliant, charming, modest, funny, curious, awkward, even shy. I was surprised to read in his wonderful memoir, On the Move, published just before he died in 2015, that he had fallen in love with a man named Bill Hayes after almost 40 years of celibacy. I had no idea, and apparently I wasn't alone. Well, Bill Hayes has written a book about falling in love with Oliver Sacks titled Insomniac City. It's also about falling in love with New York and the many people who he has met roaming the streets at night, taking photographs. The book includes some of those photos and journal entries he kept about his life with Oliver Sacks, who had some unusual quirks. For instance, if there was room in the dishwasher, he would fill it with clean plates so the dirty plates would have company. Bill Hayes is a writer, and he joins us from the NPR studios in New York. And Bill Hayes, congratulations on your book, and thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Is it strange to have loved a man who was loved by so many people who did not know him?
In a way, but it's also a great gift because so much love has come my way since Oliver's death in August of 2015.
Do you understand why so many people who didn't know him loved him?
I certainly do. You know, I had read Oliver's work before we met. I had read The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat in college, his beautiful memoir about his childhood, Uncle Tungsten, yeah. and his book Music Ophelia. And it was 9 years ago, in 2008, when I was living in San Francisco, that I got a letter in the mail from Oliver Sacks. And he had read my book, The Anatomist, which had just come out. It was a book telling the story behind the book Grey's Anatomy, the 19th century anatomy classic. So I was very surprised and flattered because he just wrote to say he enjoyed the book. He'd read it and he enjoyed it. So, of course, I wrote back.
Of course you did. Well, in fact, there's a section in the book where you write about getting that letter from Oliver Sacks, and I wonder if you could read that for us.
Oh, sure.
We were emailing about pages to read back and forth. Go ahead,
Bill. Right. Dear Mr. Hayes, dear Dr. Sacks, thus a correspondence between O and me began. A month later, I happened to be in New York and, at Oliver's invitation, paid a visit. We had lunch at a cafe across the street from his office, mussels, French fries, and several rounds of dark Belgian beer. We lingered at the table talking well into the afternoon. We found we had something other than writing in common. He, too, was a lifelong insomniac, indeed from a family of insomniacs. It was understood at an early age that one could not sleep without sedation, he told me wryly. I had not known, had never considered, as far as I recall, whether he was hetero or homosexual, single or in a relationship. And by the end of our lunch, I hadn't come to any firm conclusions on either matter, as Oliver was both very shy and quite formal, qualities I do not possess. But I did know that I was intrigued and attracted. How could one not be? He was brilliant, sweet, modest, handsome, and prone to sudden, ebullient outbursts of boyish enthusiasm. I remember how O got quite carried away talking about 19th century medical literature, its novelistic qualities, an enthusiasm I shared. We stayed in touch. I sent him photographs I had taken in Central Park of bare tree limbs. I thought they looked like vascular capillaries, but with his neurologist's eye, he felt they looked like neurons. I'm reminded of how Nabokov compared winter trees to the nervous systems of giants, he wrote back. I was sort of smitten, I had to admit.
I love that section. You say that you not only loved him, but you adored him.
Right.
And adore is such a strong word. What do you mean by that?
I used it very carefully. I had to really think about what our relationship was like. You know, I had been in a long-term relationship in San Francisco with a wonderful man named Steve. We'd been together 16 years. I'd had relationships and been in love before, but there was something very different about the quality of the relationship that Oliver and I had and how I felt toward him and about him. And he had there was something so charming and endearing and shy, while at the same time brilliant, modest, and humble. I adored him. Adore was the perfect word.
You wrote a lovely piece in the New York Times. It was on the anniversary of his death. And it was about what you and he decided you would call each other. You were not married. Partners wasn't going to work certainly for Oliver Sacks. He said he liked the word lovers. And I mean, again, you know, another powerful word. Lovers. And it seems like for him, he hadn't had a lot of lovers and was really new to understanding what love was.
It's true. This book is really about reinvention in some ways. My own reinvention, moving to New York at age 48, starting a new life. But it's also about Oliver's reinvention. You know, he fell in love at age 75. He'd never had a domestic or romantic relationship. He'd had some romances as a very young man, but had his heart very badly broken and had not been in relationships or opened his heart in that way. So I think it was a new experience for him.
as you say, you came to New York. This was after the death of your partner who you'd lived with in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Did you come to New York because that's where people go, or because you were looking, as you say, for a place to just to start over, to somehow figure out how to go on with this next chapter in your life?
Steve's death was unexpected and sudden and shattering. We'd been together a long time. It took some time for me to sort of get reoriented and regrounded, and finally I realized I just needed to start over, to start fresh, start a new life. And I'd lived my whole life on the West Coast, 25 years in San Francisco. I'd always wanted to live in New York. I'd had a kind of romantic vision of New York City, even growing up in the small town of Spokane, Washington. And I'd visited many times over the years, but decided it was finally like now or never. And so at 48, I moved to New York City.
Well, it sounds, and as you described, that you are an insomniac. It sounds like Oliver Sacks was as well. But of course, this is a city that never sleeps. So did it suit your central nervous system to be in New York?
It really did. There was a sense of kinship as an insomniac that I'd never had before. You know, I've had trouble sleeping ever since I was a little boy. And my first book, in fact, is a memoir about insomnia. But to be an insomniac in San Francisco is something very different from in New York City. And right away, I discovered that there was this whole city alive at night. Not only insomniacs sitting in parks reading books under street lamps, but delivery guys on bikes and cooks coming out of trapdoors in the sidewalk and taxi cabs and subways running. And there was something about it that suited me. And there was a kind of kinship with the city. So in a way, the book is about my romance with Oliver, my relationship with Oliver, but also about my romance and falling in love with New York.
Had you been, and I have to say, I really like the photographs, and I want to have you read a section from the book as well about just what it's like to be out in the middle of the night in New York taking pictures. But I wonder also whether being a photographer allowed you to connect with people in the city. Not everyone likes to have their picture taken, but clearly the pictures that you took, people seem to be very interested.
Right. Having a camera is a kind of tool, a vehicle for conversation, and also gave me a reason to go out and to get to know different parts of New York City. So in my first year here especially, I would slip my camera. I had a little pocket-sized camera, slip it into a pocket, take a subway to a part of New York I'd never been to before, whether Jackson Heights or Washington Heights or the Lower East Side, and explore. And I was always drawn to taking photographs of people. Yeah. So I would just walk up to people who, for one reason or another, caught my eye. And yet I always asked, and still do, always ask permission. Can I take your picture? And often people say no, and I respect that. But when they say yes, something magical happens. There's a kind of immediate sense of trust. And sometimes not only photographs, but stories come out of those encounters.
You often, at least in the book, there are lots of pictures of couples. Mm-hmm. Are you interested in couples? How they sit together, how they maybe drape themselves over each other?
Well, you know, people live their lives in public in New York City. This is something I love and discovered with both a photographer's eye and a writer's ear. And so you find lovers on park benches in New York City or on the subway bench. And there's something so open-hearted about that in New York City that I can't resist taking photographs of couples.
Well, I'd love to have you read a section, about walking on Hudson Street. Just a quick reintroduction. That's Bill Hayes, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's the author of a new book. It's called Insomniac City, New York, Oliver and Me. The Oliver is the Oliver Sacks, his lover. He was with Oliver Sacks in the last years of his life. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can text or call our comment line. That's 267-405-2006. I'd love to have a reading from this section of the book.
Sure. One night, I was walking down Hudson Street on my way home from a friend's when I spotted a dollar bill on the sidewalk. Now, even at my age, such a find seemed magical. Free money. I leaned down to pick it up, just as a woman opposite me was doing the exact same thing. "A dollar," I heard her murmur, and our heads practically bumped. We both laughed. I happened to reach it first, but it seemed ungentlemanly to take it. "Here, it's yours," I said, offering it to the woman. "No, no, no, it's yours. You got it first." "No, I insist you take it," I said. But by this point, she was walking away, arm in arm with a handsome man. She already had her prize. Suddenly, inspiration struck. "I'm going to leave it for someone else," I called back to her. "Perfect," she said over her shoulder. So I dropped the dollar bill back onto the sidewalk. It was liberating. To throw money away, or more accurately, throw it to the fates, as I had with my life by moving to New York City at age 48. I walked a few steps, and I kid you not, I hid behind a tree to watch what would take place. One couple passed by without noticing the dollar, then another, and finally a man about my age came walking in my direction. Hunched shoulders, troubled look, pulling on a cigarette. "Definitely an insomniac," I thought. "I want you to have it. It's yours. You deserve it." From my secluded vantage point, I watched as the fellow spotted the dollar. He stopped, looked around to see if anyone was in the vicinity. Perhaps someone in front of him had dropped it. But no, the sidewalk was empty. He picked up the dollar and pocketed it with a small smile, then went on his way. As did I, back to my treehouse.
I love that. The treehouse is your tiny apartment in New York.
Yes, I had a very tiny sixth-floor walk-up in the West Village that was at eye level with the trees.
You know, I have to say that passage reminded me of some of the passages that Oliver Sacks had written about just people and trying to understand people and be an observer and to watch and see what would happen. Do you think you and he shared a curiosity or share a curiosity about how people operate, who they are, why they do what they do?
Yeah, I really do. And I see this more and more in retrospect. If you'd asked me this question when we were together, I might not have seen it so obviously, because Oliver and I were very different in lots of ways. He was almost 30 years older than me. He was British. He was Oxford educated. He was a neurologist. But we were both very open to other people and curious. I think a sense of curiosity is what we had in common. He was much more shy and would approach things more from a scientific or medical neurological perspective, whereas I was maybe observing more from a photographer's and writer's perspective. We would often take walks together in the village, Oliver on my arm, and sometimes I would see someone who I had to take their picture. So he would maybe rest against a fence or a street lamp, street pole. And I would go talk to this person and come back with a photograph. And it always kind of delighted him because it's exactly the kind of thing he might be terrified to do.
Yeah.
But there he was in his position, sort of observing the whole scene unfold.
You call him O, I guess O for Oliver. What did he call you?
He called me Billy.
Billy.
Billy, which is, you know, when you're named William, there are lots of choices how you can be how you can be called. As a boy, I was called Billy, and by close friends, I've always been called Billy, but used the name Bill professionally. But Billy was what he called me, and I called him O. And in the journal that I kept over the years, because it was a journal, I abbreviated certain things. I would never write out the whole name Oliver. I would just write O. And I decided in writing this book to use raw passages from the journal itself, scenes of my life with Oliver and my life in New York City. So when Oliver comes up in the journal, it's always just as O.
Yeah. I love those journal pieces. I'm going to have you read some a little bit later in the show. But I'm curious about what it was like to get stoned with Oliver Sacks. Apparently pot cookies played a role here, right?
They did. Well, you know, Dr. Sacks was an explorer and loved to observe the brain in all its many aspects, including when stoned. This was something I thought I could just slip into the book and people wouldn't really notice. But
right.
When the New York Times review came out, the opening line of the review was, "If you ever wondered what it's like to get high with Oliver Sacks, read Bill Hayes' Insomniac City."
What was it like?
It was fun. He was open. He loved to do things just like listen to music. We would just get a little bit stoned. And, you know, one thing I noticed in looking back at the book now is how often the subject of pleasure came up in our conversations. So often Oliver, when stoned, would sort of interrogate this concept of pleasure. You know, what is pleasure? Does pleasure have to be attached to an object, as he would say, meaning connected to a piece of music or something beautiful or a handsome face? Or can pleasure be something one experiences purely on its own? So to get stoned with Oliver Sacks was fun, and also there were flights of conversation and philosophy that I've tried to capture in the book to give the reader a sense of what Oliver was like.
Do you think he was just discovering pleasure later in his life?
Well, a different kind of pleasure. One of the great joys of being with Oliver was that he had not had a domestic or romantic relationship. And he plunged right in, dove right in with his swimming goggles on and, you know, explored and enjoyed
every aspect. And you mean that literally, right?
I do. In one case, I taught Oliver how to open a bottle of champagne on New Year's Eve in one of our first years together. He'd never done that before. He'd never been with someone on New Year's Eve and had a bottle of champagne. And so I taught him how to do it, but he insisted on wearing swimming goggles just in case the cork popped off and went into his face. But he really took to domestic life. And as you said in your introduction, he sort of got acquainted with his appliances in a way that he never had before because he'd had a housekeeper who would come in once a week and do the dishes. So he'd never used his own dishwasher. And cooking and making dinner together was a big part of our life at the end of the day. And I was usually the cook. Oliver was a little afraid of the gas stove. He would have to wear potholders on both hands to actually make something. But he loved to load and unload the dishwasher.
That is Bill Hayes, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's got a new book. It's called Insomniac City, New York, Oliver and Me, talking about his relationship with Oliver Sacks in the last couple of years of Sacks' life. Also about his insomnia, his love for New York as well. You can join our conversation, text or call our comment line 267-405-2006. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Just to recap here, neurologist Oliver Sacks was a public person. He was known for writing about and humanizing people with unusual medical conditions. There was also a private side that he revealed in his last memoir, On the Move, published shortly before he died in 2015. And in the book, he revealed he was in love for the first time in his life with a man named Bill Hayes. Bill Hayes, our guest, has written a book about falling in love with Oliver Sacks and New York City. It's titled Insomniac City. And you can join us by sending us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. In his memoir, he talked about being celibate for almost 40 years. Maybe an unfair question. Do you think that was true?
Yeah, I do. I do. Oliver, it was hard for me to believe at first, too, because I had not led that life. But he'd led a very solitary, almost monk-like existence devoted to his patients and his practice and his writing. And if you look at his career, you see, you know, one amazing book after the other, as well as being a working neurologist. So that's how he devoted his life and his time. And it wasn't until 75 when chance would take place and we would meet each other and fall in love.
Well, and interesting. I mean, there are a number of sections in here about making love and very intimate moments with Oliver Sacks. At one point you say making love was like having sex with a brilliant teenager. Do you want to expand on that? I love that, by the way.
Well, I think I sort of referenced this before. One of the joys about being with Oliver is that he was discovering all this as if for the first time, whether romantic life or domestic life or sex. And yet it's also through the brain and the eyes and the mouth of Oliver Sacks, a brilliant, brilliant man. So the two together is a pretty enticing and also very fun and funny combination. And I feel in my book that I write about intimacy and the intimacy between us without being indiscreet. I don't think it's explicit. And there's a sense of of playfulness and fun in our intimate life that I tried to capture. Because let's face it, it can be that way.
Well, no, and I completely agree with you and appreciate the way you wrote about it. There's, I'm going to not say the words exactly correctly, but there's a point in which you kiss Oliver Sacks deeply, and he says to you, is that kissing or is that something you made up? Which I thought, wow, that was beautiful. But was also a kind of innocence, a kind of an ingenue on his part.
Right. That was on his 76th birthday, so it was my first summer in New York, and we were falling in love, and I gave him this very long, long kiss, and I still can just picture his face. His eyes were closed, and he said, is that what kissing is, or is that something you've invented? So it was, there was a kind of funny tone to it as well, and I was very disarmed. I mean, it was, I think we brought different things to the relationship, and so I learned things from him, and he learned things from me, and he was sweetly funny in that way.
I'd love to have you read a section where actually you're in the bathtub. He's sitting on the toilet.
Right.
This is on page 175.
Well, as you've said, I used passages from a journal I kept at Oliver's urging. He's the one who urged me to start a journal when I moved to New York because he had been a keeper of journals his whole life. So I chronicle our relationship through these journal passages. And here's an entry from October 16th. 2013. I, soaking in the bath, O perched on the toilet, talking about what he's been thinking and writing, short personal pieces, for a memoir, perhaps. He had brought with him two pillows to sit on and a very large red apple. He opens his mouth wide and takes a gigantic bite. I watch him chewing for quite a while. After he finishes, bite me off a piece, I say. He does so, dislodges the apple from his mouth, and puts the piece in my mouth. We keep talking. I add more hot water. Every other bite he gives to me. There's a quiet moment, and then, seemingly apropos of nothing, O says, I'm glad to be on planet Earth with you. It would be much lonelier otherwise. I reach for his hand and hold it. I too, I say.
I mean, that's just again the kind of, the intimacy there, the apple, of course, and the fact that you're in the tub and he's on the toilet, and you know, this is domestic life.
And there are a lot of, you know, the scenes with Oliver, most of them take place in the apartment. That's where we lived our life, a kind of cocoon of conversation and music and creativity. He was incredibly productive. In the time I was with him, he wrote three books and countless essays, including his masterful essays at the end of his life. But then I also had my own life on the streets of New York, walking, taking taxis and subways and taking photographs. And so I try in the book to capture both the interior life and the exterior life I was leading in Insomniac City.
When Michael Jackson dies, he says to you, what is Michael Jackson? And it's, you know, here's this brilliant man who helped us understand so much of the world and lived largely off the grid. As you said, he didn't have a cell phone. I think there were six names in his address book. He didn't have a computer. And it's so curious to live with someone who's so connected to this digital world that we're so involved in.
Yeah, I mean, people really have to understand there was no technology in the apartment, no Wi-Fi. Oliver never sent an email or text in his life, no computer. He did have staff in an office down the street who could send email and receive email for him. But no, he admitted this himself. He had no knowledge or really much interest in popular culture after 1955. So he didn't know who Michael Jackson was. But one of the fun things about Oliver is that he was very open. So he did say, what is Michael Jackson?
Yeah.
But I was a child of the 1970s. I had five sisters. I knew Michael Jackson well. And so his death was a milestone in my life. And I could play Michael Jackson's music for him and try to help him understand what made him a brilliant artist. And something similar occurred when we went to Iceland and saw Björk the musician and artist whom he knew through a documentary he'd done for the BBC, but he never knew Bjork's music. So before we made the trip to Iceland, I gave him a kind of crash course in Bjork, and he was very open to that, and he saw her artistry.
In fact, once you went to Iceland, she made dinner for you.
She made lunch for us.
Lunch.
She invited us to her home, and she made a really lovely lunch, and we spent the afternoon with Bjork.
You wrote a piece, I referenced this earlier, I guess on the anniversary of Oliver Sacks' mm-hmm. death, where you describe a couple of incidents, and one where you and he ended up in a gay bar, which I guess was an unusual thing for Oliver Sacks at the time, but this was on a very special day. Can you describe that?
Oh, it was so sweet. This is a story that did not end up in my book because I sort of had a rule for myself. I chronicled our relationship through these journal entries. And if a story wasn't in the journal, it didn't end up in the book. But in June 2015, so only 2 months before Oliver died, we were at our favorite bookshop in the West Village, and a clerk in the store asked us, "Are you going to Oliver Sacks night at Julius, the gay bar across the street, literally across the street?" And we looked back at him and said, "Well, what are you talking about?" And he proceeded to pull out a flyer with the headline, "Oliver Sacks Night." And it had the photograph from the cover of On the Move showing a very sexy, beautiful leather-clad Oliver Sacks.
Yeah, I remember that picture, yes.
So I remember I looked at Oliver and said, "Do you want to go?" And he said, "Sure, why not?" You know, this is a man who had not been in a gay bar since he was in his 20s. We had never been to a gay bar together, but we did go to Oliver Sacks night, and it couldn't have been more delightful. The place was filled with men and women and drag queens, and once they learned that Oliver was actually there, they announced that over the loudspeaker, and he was by then sitting on a stool by the DJ booth, and people lined up to meet him and talk to him. And what was so beautiful was that he was just having the time of his life. He had a big beaming smile on his face and a beer in one hand, and here was a line of men, gay men and women lining up to say, "Dr. Sacks, thank you." Oh, it makes me choked up.
It makes me choked up. No, absolutely.
Thank you for your books. Thank you for your writing. Thank you for helping me to understand myself or understand a member of my family. And so it was very touching.
Yeah. How did he respond to those compliments?
Well, gracefully and modestly. Again, here was this very brilliant man, but also he was very modest and sort of humble in a way. And so he took those compliments, I think, very gracefully. It was a joyous night. It was a joyous night.
Oh, it sounded fantastic.
Yeah.
So what did you squabble about, you and Oliver Sacks?
It's funny how often I get that question.
Oh, do you really? Because
it's a good question.
No, because it describes this. I mean, obviously, clearly a loving relationship. No question.
Right, but it was a normal relationship, and we were a couple. So we would squabble, of course, like any couple. Almost always over the most minor things. So let's say I'm running late, which was often the case, or we're stuck in traffic, and I've taken the wrong turn, or I get home and there's no food in the refrigerator. You know, so it was usually over minor things, what I would call cleaning out the pipes. Sometimes you just need to have a little blowout and then make up.
You had apartments in the same building, so you lived in one apartment, he lived in another. Was there a lot of sort of back and forth?
You're right. It was a very civilized arrangement for two gentlemen of our age, and we were fortunate to be able to do that. We were three floors apart. Most of our time was spent in Oliver's apartment, so 80% of the time or 90% of the time. My place, which I still have, is much smaller, and his apartment was more spacious. He was more comfortable there. He had a Bose radio in every single room, As you know, he loved classical music. That was as high-tech as Oliver got, Bose radios. And so his big indulgence maybe was to have the Goldberg Variations playing on every radio in every room all at the same time. Oh. And for Oliver, that was heaven.
Did he watch TV? Did he have a TV?
He did. We did have a TV, but very little, actually. He would watch the news. We would watch the news. But as you know, he was hearing impaired and had very little vision, really. He was blind in one eye from the cancer he'd had, and which eventually metastasized to his liver. And in his other eye, he had cataracts, so he didn't see well. And so watching a movie on TV was could be frustrating. So it's we didn't spend that much time watching TV. It was more a life of music and writing and conversation and lots of baths. And making dinner, you know, that was a big part of our life, coming together at the end of the day, cutting up some radishes and carrots, opening a bottle of wine. He would often read to me what he'd written that day, and he wrote in longhand with a fountain pen. And he had kind of a big script, so there would be many, many, many pages. And I think he kind of liked to rustle through all the pages. And then I would show him the photographs I'd taken that day on the streets of New York.
You mentioned the fact, and I remember reading this, and I reprinted it when he wrote the piece in the New York Times about learning that he had terminal cancer. And at the very end, he says, I cannot pretend I am without fear, but my predominant feeling is one of gratitude. I have loved and been loved. I've been given much, and I've given something in return. I've read and traveled and thought and written. I've had intercourse with the world and the special intercourse of writers and readers. And I remember reading that the first time and just went straight into my heart, to be perfectly honest with you. You've had two lovers who have died. That must get you thinking about your own mortality and how, not to be too maudlin here, but just what dying is.
You know, it's true. And I think it's part of the reason that I was so open to love with Oliver. I'd already suffered a really tragic, painful loss in losing Steve so unexpectedly. But also, and this is something that doesn't really come up in this book because I had written about it before, I'm a gay man, 56. I'd lived in San Francisco, moved there in 1985 at the height of the AIDS epidemic, and saw and lost friends and coworkers and neighbors to AIDS in the 80s and 90s. So death as part of life has been part of my whole adult life. And I think has sunk deeply into me and how I see the world and how I live my life. And so that is just part of life that I've experienced.
We're almost out of time here, but I read that you wrote this book in something like 6 weeks. True?
Yeah, that is true. I didn't know exactly how I would do this book, but I had this journal that I'd kept at Oliver's urging. And that turned out to be amazing material. I'd never reread it in all that time. I had gotten a fellowship at the American Academy in Rome for 6 weeks. And I brought this now 700-page journal with me, as well as other pieces of writing. And once I dipped into the journal, like within a day or two, I sort of had an epiphany. Like, this is how this book is going to work, because here were scenes with Oliver and scenes with strangers on the streets of New York, stories that needed no setup or exposition. And pretty quickly, I began to braid together these three narratives in Insomniac City.
Well, Bill Hayes, such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on your book.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. The book is entitled Insomniac City, New York, Oliver and Me. And Bill Hayes joining us from the NPR studios in New York. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll